This is an interview with Mr. Orlando T. DeLulu for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project on Law Enforcement Officers. This interview is conducted by John Bukovinsky and Mr. DeLulu's office in Liberty Township on March 2nd, 1981 at 10 o'clock a.m. Mr. DeLulu, what do you remember about your parents and family?
What do I remember about them? My parents are immigrants from Italy. They came to this country some 60 years ago. My father died when I was 15 years old in 1945. My mother is still alive. She's 87 years old. And being of an Italian origin, I lived through the Depression in 51. I was a young child during the Depression. They raised five children. And my father was a stonemason. And as a result of being a stonemason, these days they cut stone with machinery. In those days they did it by hand. The dust and the powder from the stone eventually got to him. He died of tuberculosis in 45. As far as morality, it's an Italian family. Always felt that you had to work for a living, and one of the things my mother used to tell me, and I don't know her more than my father, is that whenever you get a job, you always want to give the employer 10 hours work and 8 hour pay, and that's been pretty much the philosophy of our entire family. We've never were wealthy, even though today we're living better than we did in those days. Some of us have received a little bit more in the formal education. My brother has a degree. Another brother quit school. I have a sister who quit school. I quit school in the ninth grade. That's pretty much what I remember of my family. The food was always on the table, and there were church-going people, and that was it. I felt when my father died in 45 that I was one of two people at home that I should quit school and go to work. Well, I did. I went to work at the age of 15. I lied about my age when I quit school. Eventually I went into the service. When I came out of the service, I went back to high school and received my high school diploma in 1953 at the age of 23 years old. And from there, I got involved in law enforcement, and eventually I attended class at Youngstown State for a period of 2 years in criminal justice course in 1964, which actually I was part of the steering committee in 1963. In 64, established a criminal justice course down at Youngstown State. That's about all I can tell you about my family.
Okay, what was it like growing up in Youngstown in the late 30s and early 40s?
Well, I was born in January of 1930 in a place called the Smoky Hollow. That's Emerald Street, which lies between Andrews Avenue and Walnut, which the greatest portion of that property down there now belongs to the State University for parking lots and whatever else they're doing with it down there. As a young boy, we were poor, and of course we never, the only time you got out of the area of where you lived was when to go to school. I went to Madison Elementary School, and is when occasionally you managed to get a nickel to go to a movie on Saturday or Sunday. Played in the streets, everybody was close. There were some mixed families down there. There were Irish, Italian, Polish, Black, Jewish. It was just a mixed type of a neighborhood. And there was never any type of prejudice. I've had Black friends who ate at my house, and I've ate at their house, went to school. No type of racial disorders of any kind. We managed on our own, growing up. Eventually, those that lived in the Smoky Hollow went to Hayes Junior High and on to Rand. Really never had. Well, it's what they say, it's the good old days. I was never I was never really an active type of a person outside of hanging around the guys from the corner. I've always worked all my life. I never had really any time for outside activities. But living in those days, of course, I was 11 years old when Pearl Harbor was hit. And I saw two of my brothers go to the service. And in 1950, I went to Korea. Living in those days, I think it was just great, really. The police were well respected in those days. When you saw a cruiser coming, the fellas used to be able to tell you a cruiser was coming, they had signals, they'd be coming for three blocks. And the kids got off the street. They didn't want to be around when the policemen came down. They were not only respected, they were feared. Even though they never hassled or harassed anybody. As far as conduct in the home, well, I recall that there used to be a whistle that would blow at 9 p.m. at Republic Steel. And I imagine that whistle was lunch period for the afternoon workers. When that whistle blew, you better be home. My parents never allowed us on the street after 9 o'clock at night, and of course, then most parents didn't. If I'm going to be six blocks away and that whistle started to blow, I better be in bed before it stopped. Or else my father was waiting for me. But, you know, in those days, you felt it was, that was the way of living. Today, it's another story. You know, my parents were not rich, and I'm being the youngest of the family, had all the pass-me-downs, you know, the trousers, the shirts, the shoes, and whatever else. But that's what it was like.
Did you notice any difference in Youngstown when Mayor Henderson was elected and he brought in Police Chief Allen?
Yes, of course, I was real young when that occurred. Right off, I recall, because I was always interested in being a police officer, and I recall when Mayor Henderson was elected, and there was quite a bit of controversy when he brought in Ed Allen. I believe he was from Erie, Pennsylvania. There was a lot of gambling in Youngstown. I remember the guy on the corner that had a confectionery store. He wrote numbers in the open. People wrote, in those days, bug numbers were the greatest thing to on the number, which is today the Ohio Lottery. When Allen came in, of course, I was too young to know any other serious type of gambling, such as the crap games, whatever. When Allen came in, there was a lot of controversy. It was the first time, I think, in the history of the Youngstown Police Department that an outsider became the police chief. But I was young enough and still old enough to be able to read and understand what was going on. He chased a lot of the racketeers out of his town. It was a type of community that the Youngstown was well respected in. Even, you know, people that didn't always obey the law respected police. I know there was a lot of problems internally with the Youngstown Police Department at that time because, again, a lot of people felt that that they should have selected a member of the police department to become the chief. But Ed Allen was probably one of the best police chiefs Youngstown ever had.
You said that you were in the Korean War. Uh-huh. What branch of service were you in?
I was in the Army. I was drafted. I went to Fort Leonard Wood. I took up basic training, basic infantry training. Also, I took advanced combat engineering, and I went to demolition school. And I went to Korea as a demolition expert. I got herded up at Incheon, and eventually I was sent to an island called Kogido, where the PWs were kept. Actually, it was called Koji. Do means island, Koji Island. And I spent the rest of my Army career at Koji as a ship pilot. It's an island where large ships couldn't dock, so all of the supplies came in by LST, landing ship tanks, these big LSTs. And they were mostly manned by Japanese civilians. And my job was to get in through a Samoa boat, to go out to the LST, who was in the bay, and instruct the Japanese commander on how to hit the what part of the beach he should hit and what time, and the time of something, etc. That's basically what I did in the Korean War after being up in the front. I was discharged in May of 1953.
When you came home, what was the reception like that the people gave the Korean War veterans as to take care of World War II?
Well, in most cases, outside of my family, my own friends didn't know I was even gone. Nobody really cared. Nobody cared. You know. It was no big thing. I came back, and I was discharged up in Michigan. My brother and his wife picked me up, came home, family reunion. The next day was just like you'd never been gone. I went to work 3 days later. There was nothing, you know, no big fanfare or anything. I don't think that, of course, neither did most of the Vietnam. Well, the Vietnam War was a little different because there was a lot more controversy to that particular conflict than there was in the Korean conflict. But as I recall, when I came back home, there was no questions of, gee, what was it like over there, this and that. Nobody really gave a damn. You know, they didn't really care. You went over there and did what you did and come back. As I said, the only people who were happy, in any kind of celebration was my immediate family. Other than that, there was no big fanfare or any type of reception.
You became a deputy sheriff in 1960.
Right.
Why did you want to take another job?
Well, I, as I said, in my early life, like any other kid, I guess you either want to be a policeman or a fireman. I guess the sirens probably gave you excitement or whatever. And I did a lot of odd things from the time I come out of the service. I tended a bar, I drove a truck, I just did a number of things. And an opportunity came up where I was asked if I would like to be a police officer, and I said yes. And I was hired as a deputy sheriff and back in those days. And I took my job very seriously. Upon becoming a deputy sheriff, I worked in uniform for 2 months. Evidently, somebody must have felt that I was energetic. I was made a detective, and of course, those days they called them investigators. And I worked as an investigator for the sheriff's department for about a year. And at that point, the captain of the traffic patrol passed away, and I was placed in charge of the uniform branch and the promotion to lieutenant. But police work has really been my life. I got into police work when I was 30 years old, and it's not really a young age to get involved in police work, but I've been doing it since, well, for the last 21 years, and I enjoy it. It's the only thing I ever did in my life where I didn't resent getting out of bed and going to work. Many, many things, you know, it's tough getting out of bed. I have to go to that old grind. You know. Not that I'm afraid or concerned about working hard, it's just that I never did like what I was doing. But police work, for those that know me, I've always been known as a workaholic. I just love police work. And that desire has never left me. I've done many things as a police officer. I enjoyed every one of them.
What kind of a relationship did you have with Sheriff Davis?
Well, beginning relationship was very great. The sheriff acknowledged that I had potential. Of course, being the sheriff, he was the one responsible for moving personnel within the department if they came to attention. Working with him, he was a good sheriff. He was, well, when I say he's a good sheriff, he was a good administrator. Ray Davis, like myself, was never in police work when he entered that office. And what he learned about it is what he learned from experience. Of course, he wasn't out there every day. Most of his duties, which are primarily his responsibility, is the administration of the office, to make sure that the personnel are doing what they're supposed to be doing, or at least have captains or some superiors telling them what to do. He never became a police officer, but then again, he was never out there, and he again, that wasn't his total responsibility. We had our ups and downs in the later years. There were some things that were that occurred in the department that I didn't take care for, and I brought them to his attention, and he accepted my remarks. And in 1970, I had an opportunity to move on to another position, and he would be one of the people who would be a director of that position, which was the head of a narcotic covert operation, which a federal grant was received by three counties. And I had a little bit of a problem when I requested a leave of absence with him, and he didn't particularly care that I was leaving. There were some remarks to the extent that, you know, you were trained as a good police officer by my administration, and you should remain with us. But I felt an opportunity to do something which I thought I was really going to enjoy doing. It was a problem that was starting to become a real problem, and that was drugs. I had formal training in the drug field in 1964. I attended the Bureau of Narcotics School. I gave lectures on drugs during the next 6 years, and I felt that I was the right man for the job, and evidently six people who coordinated that program, which would be three sheriffs, Astabula, Trumbull, and Mahoning, and the three chiefs of the largest cities, Astabula, Warren, and Hicksdown, felt that I was the man from five or six other applicants. And I was given the job. After a few months of being on the job, and Ray Davis being a coordinator, things smoothed out. And they smoothed out. He knew that that I was doing what I wanted to do. And, the program was a year-to-year base. It depended on your progress, what type of work you did, and the federal government saw fit to refund that program for the maximum of 5 years under LEAA programs. So I stayed with the program until about May of 1976, at which time Ray Davis gave me my job back as captain of the Sheriff's Department. I went back with the Sheriff's Department. And with no real specific duties, because when I left in 1970, I was the head of the Detective Bureau, and there was somebody else in charge of the Detective Bureau when I came back. So what I was a roustabout. If there were some internal problems, I was requested to check them. If there were jailbreaks, I was requested to investigate them. I was given an older file of a family of three who were murdered in 1973 to work on that. 3 years later, I was given that file. That's pretty much what I did during my last 7 months with Ray Davis. Of course, he was defeated in June of 1976. And Mike Yarish became sheriff, and politics being what they are, there were a number of people fired or laid off or whatever. They just demoted me from a captain down to a detective sergeant. I remained a detective. The position titles never meant anything to me. Never in my life was the amount of money I was making. Along with that cut, I took a $3,000 cut in pay. In 1977, I went from $13,500 a year to $11,500 a year, and I just couldn't afford it. Many police officers can't afford it, but they were policemen who took, who moonlight. They did other jobs, whether they be police jobs, working Saturdays and Sundays, putting in somebody's driveway or painting or whatever. I always felt that a policeman never should have to work a part-time job. I always felt that he should be paid sufficient amount of money to survive and provide, and he should be available. If you work 8 to 4 and you go home and something happens at 8 o'clock at night, you should be able to go back out to work. That was always my position. I never held a part-time job simply because I felt that I was obligated, and I was important to the police department, and if they needed me, I was available. So as a result of that, I had to leave the sheriff's department because I couldn't afford to survive on $11,500 at that time. I had a wife and twin boys, 16 years old, and I put out some feelers. I was offered about four or five different jobs. And Liberty offered me a job, and I accepted. And I resigned from the Sheriff's Department on March 1st, 1977.
When you arrested somebody back in 1960 as a deputy, what kind of procedure did you have to do?
Well, obviously not as stringent as it is today. When you arrest somebody, we were able to pick somebody up, the suspect, hypothetically, in a burglary. And you had information, not necessarily corroborated information. You picked up a subject. You brought him in, and you started questioning him. There was no such thing as advising him his rights. The Miranda warning didn't come at that point. Just worked on him and worked on him. It could have occurred in other departments. It could have occurred in my own department. There was no third-degree method that I can recall, you know, under the heavy lights or the club in your hand and this and that. Normally, what you did in those days is you talked to the subject and you would tell them that you had so much information and this and that. And if he was smart, if he was bright, he would say, fine, go ahead and charge me. And if he wasn't too bright, he would believe what you said, and at that point probably give you a confession. There wasn't, today it's a lot different. Not that I'm against it. I think that the Miranda warning is the best thing that ever happened to this man. I think a lot of things that the Supreme Court came down with, not all, a lot of them, were good, were healthy, very healthy. Very, very healthy for policemen to be better educated. In those days, nobody ever heard about advanced schools, going to a university and taking up the criminal justice course, in-service type training. When I got on the job, they handed me a uniform and a gun and a badge and says, this is it. Things have changed. As a result of Supreme Court rulings, the state made it mandatory that a police officer has to attend X amount of hours before even issuing a gun. And then he has to attend so many more hours within the first year before he's even considered a full-fledged police officer today in the state of Ohio. And some of the things I don't particularly care for, some of the rulings came down from the Supreme Court. But overall, I think most of the rulings that came down from the Supreme Court were very, very good. And again, very healthy for policemen and departments. It taught them how to do the job and put more effort and a little bit more energy in it.
Was there anything like a typical day for you back then?
Well, no day is typical in police work. The only thing typical about it any day is the fact that you arrived at work at a time and you had a cup of coffee and you went over last night's reports and you bullshitted for another 30 minutes and you went out on your calls. Now, it's typical up to that point. Then, of course, the rest of the day is never the same as it was the day before. Maybe that day they were shorthanded and they handed you two warrants, one being a warrant for somebody that failed to pay a fine, and the other one may be for a mental patient. The Sheriff's Department's responsible for conveying mental patients through probate court. Those were probably the most unwanted details anybody wanted, was to get a warrant to go to somebody's house and drag them out of the house and take them to Woodside. Very, very dangerous because they never gave you much information on that subject's condition, except that you got a warrant, and it says that you will convey so-and-so to Woodside Hospital upon receiving this warrant. Or you may get a couple of burglaries to investigate, or while you're working, you may have a burglary in progress, or a robbery in progress, or a homicide. Every day, it was not a typical day, up till the point you left that last coffee break. You could have went out and just about done anything. There were days you may have went out and just drove all over the county and never did a damn thing because there wasn't anything going on. There were other days that you probably wouldn't get back in until 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Working for the Sheriff's Department is a very difficult thing, particularly if you're a detective, because you have a lot of county. If you've got a case down in Sebring, Ohio, you had to drive 70 miles round trip to get down there. Not being too familiar with that part of the county, you would always have more problems trying to solve the matter than you would if they occurred in Austintown or Boardman or something nearby, where you're basically familiar with Youngstown characters who would go out and do that type of crime. But when you get down to those southern part of the county, over in Ellsworth, North Lima, Springfield, Smith, townships down there, it was a problem. But, you know, anything could happen any one day. And I think that's really why today, even today, come to work. I don't know what's going to happen. We have a roll call in the morning. I find things on my desk that I have to check into. I don't find any day to be typical. There's no such thing as a typical day in police work.
Okay, in the early 60s, Youngstown was in the midst of wholesale bombings. Mm-hmm. As a law enforcement officer, what do you remember about that?
Well, I used to have a piece of paper listing everybody that was shot and bombed, and trying to develop my own pattern. They were all the result of gambling, one way or the other, racketeering, let's put it that way. I remember, let's see, one of the bombings was I was either there as a bystander, as an observer, or actually involved. I remember probably about four or five. Names at this point, I don't recall right off, except a couple. Charlie Cavalier and his two sons were in the car. And he went to start the car up in the garage, and the bomb evidently was under the was underneath the car, under the front seat, and it just blew him and his son that was in the middle in the pieces. And of course the son was sitting on the side door, lost his left leg, and managed to survive. I remember the bombing of Billy Naples. He got into a vehicle in the garage on Madison Avenue off of Elm Street. And he was bombed. I happened to be there because they found a shotgun. The Youngstown police contacted me. They wanted me to trace the shotgun, and I had traced the shotgun for him because it was stolen out of the county many years ago. Well, a few months prior to that, it was stolen from Stanwell Thompson Warehouse. I was there. I saw the body. I was also at again, names.
How about De Niro's?
De Niro bombing, I was there. That's the very first one. As I recall, that was probably around January, February, March of 1961. I happened to be leaving my office. It was Sunday night. I was down there doing some paperwork. And, well, what it was this, I recall now. We had just broke up again with a gang of some safe burglars. And I lived in Struthers at the time, and I was headed out Market Street. I turned left on Middle Oakland, and I don't know how far down Middle Oakland I got. I heard the explosion. And then I heard something on the radio that there was a bombing, and I immediately turned around and went back down to the bombing. Of course, it was right directly across from Cicero's restaurant. Right now it's not there anymore. The Colonial House restaurant, right across the street there, from the Strauss's. Yeah, that was the first one, the Barrow bombing. I was there. Of course, there were others, which I wasn't at. Bombings that I did attend were there. It was De Niro and the Cavalier and the Billy Naples. There was another one of a young Greek fellow that came out of an apartment around 11:30, 12 o'clock in the morning across the street from St. Elizabeth Hospital. I believe his brother's a counselor down in Camel. He was from Camel. And high noon, turned on ignition, and his car was just smithereens. It blew up. And I was down there when that occurred. Well, not when it occurred, thereafter. Of course, the bombings again were mostly attributed to racketeering. Even though none of them were ever solved, none of them were solved this day. I imagine, like anything else, we have burglaries, we have robberies, we have lists of suspects. But you're talking about people that you just can't say, come on in and let's talk about it, because you'll get a call from your lawyer. You know? They're not interested in talking about something he did. But I, there hasn't been any bombing since I've been in police work where somebody died as a result of the bombing that has ever been solved. Bombs in those days were when they set the dynamite in the underneath the hood of the car, and of course tie the wires to the coil and the ignition, of course, set off the spark, which set off the cap, and set off the dynamite. And what used to happen after about three of those bombings, all racketeers would lift up their hood before they started the car, and there was a number of them that became a little more sophisticated. They had an automatic starter, like your garage door opener, that started the car. Well, they defeated that too, because what they did at that point is put the bomb underneath the car, where it wasn't visible. And it would go off by movement of the car, such as a percussion cap set underneath the tire. That's called being in demolitions. You're asking, I told you earlier I was in demolition, now I'm telling you about bombings. What we call is a pressure release cap. What happens is a car is parked and this pressure release cap, it's like a little thing like this, and you shove it underneath the tire, the car, and it's down tight. And of course, there's a wire that goes to the dynamite. Now, the minute your car starts and you move the car, it expands that pressure release, sets off a cap, which sets off the dynamite. So there's no way you could start your car by remote control and see that that happened. The car actually had to move. This occurred in a couple of them. The one that I remember very closely, not that I was there, was the Alexander boy. That's how his happened. There's a pressure release cap underneath his tire. But bombings sort of left this valley. Last bombing that I recall was the one in Cleveland where this Green was bombed and Ronnie Carabia in a penitentiary court, but most of the gangland slaying since then have been done by one of the most dangerous weapons, the shotgun, close range, which leaves no doubt.
Okay, you mentioned like the gambling activities that went on. How about raids? Did you do many raids?
Oh yeah, we being a sheriff, he had complete responsibility of the entire county. He had the power to go anywhere. There was a lack of local law enforcement and investigation. The sheriff was called upon to investigate, and he had to go work on it. Yes, I've been on several in those days, and a lot of them came to grand jury action, in which people were indicted, and there were warrants, subpoenas, whatever, issued for raids. We did a lot of them down on Center Street, which was the Naples place. Some in Struthers, Ohio, Carabias gambling, Camel, Ohio. I probably been in probably about 25 or 30 gambling raids in those days. They're mostly, in those days, was looking for sports activity, sports gambling. Parlays, football parlays, numbers action, horse betting. Nothing, the era of it was before I became a policeman, where they had established gambling places in the county. We didn't go in and just like being at the track, look at the board. Those were the days when nobody bothered anybody. And that's probably, well, you would say those were in the 50s, when they were big things. But at that time, there was a syndicate, evidently, that controlled gambling, and there was no inner fighting. The inner fighting came afterwards, where change of elective offices, where an influential type of a racketeer or a syndicate would come in and pay for the campaign of a sheriff, of a mayor, of a judge, and where they became the power. And the people that were in power did not want to relinquish their power. They wanted to continue to operate. And the power once on, and the raids were come about, and if that didn't work, then they were shot and bombed. Yeah, I was involved in a lot of gambling raids when I was with the sheriff.
What kind of working relationship did the sheriff's office have with other local police organizations like Youngstown Police Department?
Well, they were always good, with the exception of occasionally you would come into Youngstown and make a raid, which they weren't too happy about. If you came in with a search warrant, you hit places in the city, and not tell them about it, they were very disturbed. And I don't blame them for being disturbed. We really didn't have any department, per department animosities with like Boardman, Austintown, Campbell, and Struthers. There would be personal animosities between a officer of the sheriff's department and a officer of Camel or that. But generally, we work together. It's not the type of an atmosphere that I like, because I happen to be probably the strongest advocate of cooperation and communication between police departments, because we need each other. Sure, when you went into the city of Youngstown and you made a raid, for whatever reason, they were certainly disturbed about it. Now, you know, obviously, what were they disturbed about? Well, were they getting paid off, or did we embarrass them by making a raid of a situation which they were completely unaware of? It could have been anything. I don't blame them. Yes, they used to get disturbed, and they get disturbed today, too. I understand that, you know, occasionally a sheriff will come into a community and make a drug raid without informing the local authority. They become disturbed about it. It leaves a bad taste in people's mouth. It really does. And I would never do it. As if I was a sheriff, I would never do it. Of course, being a police chief, I'm only concerned and responsible for the detention, so I couldn't go into Girard or any place to begin with. But I would be totally against it, because it leaves a bad taste in people's mouth, because if the sheriff comes in and makes a raid right now in Liberty Township, and he conducts a drug raid, something that we were unaware of was even occurring, then it leaves the people of Liberty Township to believe that we're not doing our job, or there are those who would believe that I'm taking a payoff, okay? And it's not a very healthy situation. I say this, if I were a sheriff and I had a complaint from Liberty Township or Girard, wherever the case may be, and somebody said, well, look, we have a drug operation down here that's been going on, and nobody's doing anything about it. Or we have a gambling operation down here that's been going on. The local police, the local mayor, don't want to get involved. And I would say, fine, I'll take that information. And I would immediately get on the phone and call that mayor or the chief and tell him, look, I had this complaint about John Doe, who has a gambling establishment on 6th Street. And I would like you to know that the complaint is that you people aren't doing anything about it. Now, how about giving me some satisfaction telling me you're going to do something about it? Fine. Now, if 2 weeks go by and nothing happened, 3 weeks go by and nothing happened, and I would send an investigator in there to see if the information was correct. And if it was correct, then I would go in there and knock it off myself. But only after I've informed them about it. I would, you know, look, they can't come back to see me and say, hey, you made me look bad. I can always say, hey, look, my log shows 3 p.m. on so-and-so. I spoke to you, and I told you about it. You said you were going to take care of it. Evidently, you either didn't care to, or whatever the reason was. And I also have a responsibility as a sheriff. I'm sworn by law as the chief law enforcement officer in the community or the county, and that where there is a lack of law enforcement, it's my responsibility. I don't have to tell you, but I told you anyway. Well, that's the type of thing I would do. And I think that does happen a lot of times. I think it happens a lot of times where sheriffs will call, particularly in an election year. They'll call the local community and tell the sheriff or tell the police chief and tell the mayor, look, chief, we have this kind of complaint. Now, I've been here since March 1st of 1977. In the role of a captain up until January 1st of 80, which I became the chief. I have to this date never have received a call from the sheriff to tell me there's anything going on. And to this date, has the sheriff ever came into this community and told me, and did something? And I'm going to stand here and pat myself and the police department on the back, but we have a pretty much law-abiding community. Whatever problems occur, we manage to take care of. In fact, I personally signed 2 search warrants about 5 weeks ago of 2 bookmakers that came in here from Youngstown and we arrested them. But now I'm going off on a tangent. The original question was cooperation. I think that was what your question was. Cooperation is a big thing in police work, and I tell my guys all the time. The police department calls you up and needs information, whatever, give it to them. Well, they say sometimes police officer, well, this certain officer called me up. He wants to know about an individual whom I have a file on, but I don't trust him. Hey, look, my philosophy is this. You work with a police officer till the time comes where he has proved himself not to be trusted, or that department. But until then, you do work with him. Cooperation is a very important thing. And again, yeah. It may happen today. There may be somebody in this township selling dope that I'm not aware of, or anybody's aware of, and the sheriff may come in here this afternoon and knock it off without telling me about it. I'm not going to be too happy about it. I'm going to read about it tomorrow. And the people around me are going to say, well, yeah, I go in a restaurant, or people walk in and say, hey, how come the sheriff had to do this? Well, I see people doing their job. And again, there's only 2 things that occur to them. One, that we're taking a payoff. We don't know what's going on in the community. It's not a healthy situation because, let's face it, whether they're sheriff deputies, police officers, or whatever, we're all apples, and we're all in one bushel. And if one of us is rotten, the entire bushel is rotten as far as the general public is concerned. So that's the situation.
Let me switch sides from that.